Hey,
you're listening to Avid Research.
Avid Research.
Avid Research.
An Australian STEM podcast.
Where we answer the questions you never quite got around to asking.
Welcome back to the show, team. My name's Amelia, and today we have an awesome returnee guest. We have Dr. Jared come back to the show. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jared.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
It's an absolute pleasure to see you again. I think it's been a couple of years maybe, so no doubt you've been up to interesting stuff. What's been happening? What's going on?
Yes, it's probably been three years maybe. I think it's been too long, I think, is the short way of saying that. But yes, a lot has happened in that time, and I've been to some pretty amazing places, but I've just returned from probably the most amazing place that I've ever been to, most incredible, most expensive as well, but definitely worth it, and that is Antarctica. So I'd love to sort of dive into what that was like today, chatting with you.
I think we have to pause for a moment, though, while everyone who hasn't yet been to Antarctica has their moment of jealousy, because it's, puns aside, it's a pretty cool place, and, you know, I haven't been there yet. I have been to the Arctic, though, so we might be able to, have a bit of a compare there.
Yep.
But yeah, so Antarctica, why did you go?
Well, for many reasons. You know, a lot of people go for some kind of the more obvious reasons, like it's their seventh continent. They want to go and see the penguins. And that's kind of the only reason why they go, right? It's kind of a bucket list thing. They just kind of tick it off, go see the penguins, and then back to work. And it definitely isn't that for me, or it wasn't that for me. I wanted to not only see the penguins, of course, and it was coincidentally my seventh continent, but it wasn't the reason why I went.
Penguins are cool.
Penguins are cool, I can confirm. They are adorable, they are cool, they are gross and loud, as I will go into a little bit more later. But yeah, for me it was bigger than that. You know, we hear so much about climate change recently. The narrative is that it's a disaster, right? And it's happening very quickly. It's our fault. We're not doing enough. And I really wanted to go and see how it was affecting the last true wilderness on the planet, which is Antarctica, right? It's the coldest, windiest, highest and driest place on the planet. So there's a lot of superlatives. They're all absolutely make sense once you get there. But, you know, it's the last true wilderness is what kind of people assign Antarctica to. And I wanted to see what was happening down there. How is climate change affecting the whales? How's it affecting the penguins and the ice and the glaciers and the currents and all of that? So that was probably a main driver for me. And I think it was also as like an indirect outcome, I guess, of the trip is, you know, what can I do to help Antarctica? What can I do to help the whales and the penguins? So I've thankfully come away with a lot of information as well from that trip.
So, it sounds a little bit sad, really, being like, I want to see this before it melts. But, I mean, it's a good driver. It gets people moving.
It does.
I guess. And I think there's a similar thing with, the Great Barrier Reef. I don't know. Have you ever read Last Chance to See by Douglas Adams?
I have not, no.
You and all the listeners should. It's a similar concept. He went around or got sponsored to go around and see the last of a bunch of animals before they got made extinct and wrote a book about it, which is very Douglas Adams-y. So you're not alone in this.
Good.
Is being a venture.
Yeah.
It's really sad, and now I feel like I need to get my skates on.
Yes. And that's kind of, you know, what you feel once you leave. Well, it's what I felt anyway, once I got there and once I'd left as well. So, you know, there's a lot of science going on down there and a whole bunch of amazing areas of STEM. I went on essentially a tourist boat. You know, you can go online and book a trip around the Sahara Desert or the Serengeti. You can also go online and book a trip to Antarctica just like that, which was actually surprising to me. I didn't realize how, I guess, big the tourism industry is in Antarctica. I think last year, or the last season, the 2023 season, there were 100,000 people that visited Antarctica, which is probably surprising to a lot of people, being the crazy, you know, coldest, windiest, highest, driest place that you could go to, and 100,000 people went there. So there's definitely a lot of people going. There's a lot of boats going. There's like 50 different tours that go during the period that you can, which is kind of summer and a couple of weeks shouldering that season. And the good thing about that, all of that tourism industry, is that it's actually very well regulated too, unlike many of the other tours that you go to or go on around the world. You know, you could go to the Amazon and go on riverboat tours and rainforest tours and things like that. But what happens in Antarctica is very tightly regulated, thankfully, because it needs to be. And, you know, I would definitely say there needs to be more regulation, of course. But the fact that it is so well regulated is great, because you get a chance to learn from the scientists that are all on board on your boats too. There's people, you know, researching whales and seabirds and penguins and the clouds and currents and things like that. So you really get in the thick of it, not just, you know, walking out on ice and seeing penguins in that way, but you're also in the thick of the research that's going on, which is super cool. For me, especially, you know, being a scientist, I was kind of sitting right beside them the entire time, like, oh my God, tell me about that current that you're looking at, and tell me about that bird. What happened with that cloud over there? So I was definitely a lot nerdier than many of the guests, but part of that, those regulations, is to include a lot of that science and educate a lot of the people that go down there, which I think is a fantastic initiative.
That's awesome. It's like kind of how it should be.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk just a little bit about the logistics? Like, we don't need to talk dollars, but like, what route did you take?
Yeah.
How long? And I guess paint a bit of a picture if someone was thinking, like, more of the tourist.
Yeah.
Starters.
So there are a couple of different options on how to get there, all with varying times and varying costs and varying logistics. So for me, living in Melbourne, the easiest route, I thought, for me would have been to go to Tassie, and then you can actually take a boat from Tasmania down to Antarctica. Just being so close, you know, we're in the Southern Hemisphere, we're at the southern tip of Australia, it should be pretty easy. And it is in one way, but it also takes a lot longer than it does from South America, for example. So from Tasmania to Antarctica, it takes, I think, 5 days there on a boat and then 5 days back. So it's a pretty long trip. For a couple of days in Antarctica, it's kind of a 3 week trip. And the same goes for New Zealand, really. You can leave from Christchurch or areas a bit further south, and again, it takes like 5 or 6 days to get there on a boat. So it takes forever. You can also fly from Australia or from New Zealand. Those flights are generally there and back. You might fly, kind of get your boots on the ground and then leave again. But the most popular route that people go on, and what I did too, was to fly to South America and actually leave from Ushuaia, which is the southern tip of Argentina. And it seems a little bit funny to fly to the other side of the world to then go immediately south. But it's actually a lot quicker for me to fly from Melbourne to Santiago to then Buenos Aires and then to Ushuaia and then take a boat down to Antarctica, because it only takes 2 days from Ushuaia versus the 5 or 6 from Australia. So there's actually kind of like a jutting out section of Antarctica called the peninsula. And very coincidentally for South America, it almost kind of reaches South America. There's like a little gap between South America and the Antarctic Peninsula, which thankfully for all of us tourists only takes 2 days, whereas the rest of Antarctica takes like 5 or 6 days. So that was how I got there.
I'm just going to, like, a little bit of fun fact is that, like, narrowing of the ocean is also why it was, like, so exciting traveling by, like, boat back in the day, where they'd, like, go around, and it's because the huge amount of water gets really, really narrow and really, really intense.
It does, yes. Yeah. And that's kind of, yeah, part of the thrill of going to Antarctica via boat is you have to traverse that area of sea called the Drake Passage. From South America to the peninsula, it's called the Drake Passage. And it is the roughest sea in the world as well, because if you look at a world map or a globe, there's actually no other land between or at that latitude of the planet. So really, wind basically blows from one end of the planet and goes all the way around and comes back, and it's just this endless cycle of wind making waves. So when you get told about your boat ride down, they kind of prepare you for what could be. So you could either get the Drake Lake, where it's very calm, kind of, you know, 1 meter waves, nothing really to worry about, or you get the Drake Shake, which can be anywhere from 1 meter to 12 meters. So it can be, it's very much luck of the draw. It changes day to day, it changes within the day. And I was very, very lucky that I got the Drake Lake-ish both ways. We only had 3 or 4 meter swells, and it was still rocking our boat quite a bit, but, you know, people weren't confined to their rooms, people weren't, you know, seasick every day, things like that. So we were actually very lucky in the crossing.
Nice. How long did you actually get around or near Antarctica?
So my whole trip from Ushuaia and back was, I think it was a nine day trip. 4 of that is on the Drake Passage, 2 days there, 2 days back. And then the other kind of 4.5 is in Antarctica. So we had 4-ish, 4 to 5-ish days in Antarctica. And then, again, this sort of depends on what trip you go on, but you could make 1 or 2 trips per day to an island off Antarctica or to the mainland, for example. And that's, yeah, depends on what kind of trip you're on and depends on weather, which is wild in Antarctica. It changes, you know, hour to hour. So you've really got to have luck on your side to go multiple times a day. And again, lucky for me, we were able to get out twice per day. So we got to see a lot.
Wow. Horrible question. Is there a highlight?
It is a horrible question. Yeah. For me, I think kind of just broadly was some of us got to go kayaking on our trip. We were very, very lucky to have a kayaking program part of our trip. And just being that close to the sea and the penguins porpoising around in the sea and, you know, whales surfacing and breaching, you know, 5 meters from your kayak and seals and everything is just so much closer to you. So you feel so much more connected to it all. And so, you know, broadly, I would say kayaking, but it's impossible to say, you know, nail it down to a specific thing because every trip was different, every day was different, and they were all amazing for a different reason. So I'm going to kind of have a cop-out answer and say kayaking. But yeah, the whole trip was a highlight.
That makes sense. But also kayaking, you're traveling almost silently.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, you're going to feel way more connected to the nature around you than on a Zodiac, for example.
Absolutely, yeah. So the kayak guides that we had were part of the ship crew, and they were great in acknowledging a moment like that. Like, this is such a peaceful experience that we're having in Antarctica right now. And, you know, there were several moments, well, definitely the first day where everybody is kind of kayaking around and got their phones out, taking a photo of everything, right? Every iceberg, every bird, every penguin, every seal. And the guides were very good at grounding us on where we were and what's happening. And it was like, put your phones away, put your paddles down. Let's just sit here for 5-10 minutes and let's just look. Let's just listen. Let's just smell. Just experience Antarctica. And we were very lucky to have people like that grounded us. So, yeah, being that close really does connect you a lot more with where you were.
You just mentioned smell.
Yes, I did.
What's it smell like?
Well, it depends where you are. A lot of people...
And how close you are to a penguin's bum.
How close you are to a penguin's bum, yes. Or 10,000 penguin bums. You know, there are some...
Or seals.
Or seals. Seals are a bit... Yes. There are a lot of smelly animals that people... You don't really think of Antarctica as kind of a smelly place. And granted, a lot of it isn't because it's such a large place and the animals are spread out a lot. And I will say, you know, the caveat being, you know, once you get on land and then you walk anywhere near a penguin colony, for example, firstly, you could hear them a mile away because there's, you know, 1 or 10,000 of them strong in a pretty isolated, concentrated area. So you can hear them for miles. And then once you get on land, oh my goodness, you know, it's penguins are a lot more disgusting than people think, you know, because they are in such a concentrated area. They're pooing and peeing, you know, where they're standing and where they're breeding and where they're raising their chicks. So they're all just covered in pee and poo for most of the part that most of the places that we saw anyway. So it's definitely a side of Antarctica some people mention, but it's not really one that people mention as like a highlight, for example. Yeah, you wonder why, right? You wonder why. But it's also so cool to see that too. You know, that's just penguins being penguins. You know, they're very different to what they are in a zoo, for example, or on the beaches of Phillip Island in Melbourne. So it's just another side of nature that people don't really discuss that much, but it was cool to see, regardless.
So the penguins on Phillip Island, I am aware that they have fleas.
Mm.
And it's common for the researchers to get fleas off the penguins,
mm.
which I think is amazing that a flea can survive, like, underwater. Did I mention fleas?
No fleas on our trip, actually. Oh. I'm not sure if it's in the Antarctic penguins or not, but, you know, they will have their own versions of parasites and things like that there that are native to Antarctica. And there is one, they don't have fleas, but there is one virus that's just landed in Antarctica. I think it was only 3 weeks ago for the first time. It was actually on our trip. That
not from you.
Not from us, hopefully. But we're still trying to, researchers are still trying to find out the vector, you know, what actually brought it over, and that it's avian flu. So we might have heard it in the news over the past couple of years. It's probably been overshadowed by COVID a lot, but the avian populations all around the world have had their own flu going on for the same amount of time, really, that we've been dealing with COVID. So it's killed them in the millions globally. The only place in the world currently that doesn't have it, I think, is actually Australia and New Zealand. I'm not sure why. That's probably a question for the avian flu researchers, but researchers were very worried if it was to reach Antarctica, and when it does, what would happen. You can't really stop avian flu because it's transmitted by birds, and birds fly, birds migrate. You know, what can you do to stop a migrating bird? Very, very, very little. So it's part of the natural cycle that birds migrate to and from South America and Antarctica each year. So when it was discovered in South America, researchers kind of let out this enormous sigh. One, you know, for terrible news for South American birds, but it's kind of, it's inevitable that it was going to reach Antarctica. It's just a matter of when. And that when was answered when on our trip, and it was, yeah, almost exactly a month ago that it hit Antarctica for the first time. You know, it may have been there earlier, but it was the first tested and reported positive case. So it could really spell a disaster for, unfortunately, animals like the penguins and animals that then eat them too, like the leopard seals and killer whales. You know, it could infect them too, mm-hmm. but we're really waiting with bated breath on what's going to happen, because we just don't know how it's going to behave in Antarctica. You know, it is such a crazy environment. It is so cold and so windy. Will it survive? We just don't know, but hopefully it doesn't wreak as much havoc as it has in other places in the world.
Like, there's a lot of fascinating, sad, fascinating things about that. And, like, one is just that, as a sort of normal person, while I know that penguins are birds, like, technically I know, like, when I think of birds, yeah. I don't think of penguins.
Yes, I know. And so do I still. To this day, I still go, you know, birds and penguins. And it's like, well, they are birds.
No. Yeah. And they clearly have a lot of, you know, genetic similarities to be able to catch the same viruses. He is hoping that because they're not in big, like, warehouses, like, squished together, you know, penguins hang out in the open air.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
He's hoping, yeah, because they do, like I said, you know, there are very large colonies, but they do spread out and walk around and swim around a lot, and hopefully, yeah, it's not going to just wipe through a colony, for example. You know, everybody that knows about it, I think, is really crossing their fingers that it's not going to be as bad as we think it could.
Yep. There's just really no end to the threats.
No.
Like, you start with whalers and sealers.
Yep.
And all the way through to bird flu.
All the way through, yeah. It just keeps coming, you know. And that was actually one of the really cool parts of our trip was 3 of the days that we were there, it was experiencing what you would see on the nature docos. It's the blue and white, beautiful Antarctica, penguins and whales everywhere, and it's just fantastic. And then the final day we went to a couple of areas that were ex-whaling stations as well. And actually, the day before we went, the expedition staff said, I know you've had an amazing time, but tomorrow will also be an amazing time, but for a completely different reason. Tomorrow, everything's going to change. And we went to these places, and, you know, the blues and whites that you think of with Antarctica were replaced with, like, grays and browns and reds and yellows, like much more moody sort of colors, and talking about history like of whaling in Antarctica. It was completely different, and again, like, grounds you and how much this continent and these animals have been through and are still going through, right? You know, whaling was banned in 1986 for commercial whaling. Was, we know it still happens, and even though that may be banned, you know, there's ways around things like these rules, and now they've got avian flu. So yeah, it's just an endless list, unfortunately.
It really is. I am curious, because obviously you're quite, you know, well read, you know a bit about stuff, an Antarcticologist, but
I know a thing or two.
You know a thing or two. What down there surprised you?
Everything. you know, it's just a place that you can't describe enough. And it's, you know, there's people that have been going on these trips, like the expedition staff have been there 40, 50 times, and they're still there taking photos of a mountain. You know, it's still impressive and it's still amazing. You know, there was one person there who'd been 53 times, I think, and I saw him taking photos of a penguin. Like, that's got to mean something, right? Like, this guy has seen everything and he's still taking photos like we are. But yeah, I think what surprised me the most was the scale of everything. You know, I'm not aware of, and there may be somewhere in the world, but I'm not aware of one, of a mountain range that actually meets the sea, like straight into the sea, like mountain peak all the way into the sea. There's probably somewhere, but I haven't seen it yet. So for me, that was incredible. You know, you're on a boat, like this kind of 8-story boat, fairly large, right? And you're sailing between kilometer and a half high mountains directly beside you. And then you look over the boat and you see krill, which are 2 centimeters long. So you've got these, and then, you know, smaller than that, you've got the plankton. So how can you, it's this place where you've got plankton, which you can't even see, and then kilometer high mountains. And then it's deathly quiet 1 second, and then you turn around the corner and then you hear 10,000 penguins. So it's the scale that you just can't really process it, whether it's the noise or the sights or the smells, again with the penguins. It lives in this kind of incredible duality of so big and so small, and so loud and so quiet, and so calm and then so violently stormy the next moment as well. So the change and the scale, I think, of Antarctica in the 4 days that I was there for probably surprised me the most.
Because that's not really something you can prepare for. Like, you can't.
No, like
you can read about it.
You can read about it and you can try, but you just, yeah, you can't kind of mentally prepare for, all right, we're going to go on land, and then it's completely calm. And then within 30 minutes, you've got 50 kilometer hour winds. And then you've got to get back on your Zodiac, the little kind of inflatable speedboat that takes you from your big boat to shore. You know, you've got to race back to your Zodiac and then get back on the boat before the winds get up to 60, 70, 80. And then it's like, we're in big, big trouble if that happens. And it does happen, but it happens so quickly. So yeah, you just can't prepare as a tourist anyway. You know, the expedition staff are well versed in this sort of stuff, and you've got to prepare for the worst every single time you go out. And thankfully they do. But yeah, as someone who doesn't kind of live and breathe and work down there, I definitely couldn't prepare.
That's good. That's what the experts are for.
Yes, exactly.
The sort of flip side question is, after having been down there and seen all that, what are you afraid of?
I mean, probably Antarctica kind of knocking on my back door. It's because I've been saying how beautiful and amazing and impressive it is, but it is so fragile right now. You know, climate change is ravaging the world, really. You know, we've seen bushfires and all of these things, but we see every now and then, but it's pretty uncommon to hear about what's happening in Antarctica. And Antarctica is one of the most important places to the planet, not just the seas and the ocean life, but to us too. The microalgae, for example, that live in the seas of Antarctica and throughout the world, but a large portion of it lives in Antarctica, are responsible for every second breath that we take. So if the seas are getting too warm, which they are, then the phytoplankton and the microalgae are starting to die and they're not breeding as much. So we will literally not have air to breathe. And the glaciers are melting, the ice sheets are melting. And that's, again, changing the temperature of the sea and the level of the sea. If Antarctica fully melted, all of the ice on Antarctica, then seas would rise by 70 meters, 70. So that would put almost every country underwater, not fully, but mostly underwater. There's just so much at stake with Antarctica, and people think it doesn't really affect you, but it is, and it will in the future too. You know, it's like I said with the algae in our breath. All of the ice in Antarctica as well acts as this kind of global insulator. It reflects away so much of the sunlight and helps regulate the planet and the greenhouse effect, which is natural but running amok now with climate change. So less ice means more heat for the planet. So, and then it becomes this cycle, right? Less ice, then it heats more. And then if it heats more, then more ice will melt. And then it's this vicious cycle of everything is just going to exponentially just melt and get too warm, which will then affect all of the ocean currents. And they're regulated really tightly by the cold, nutrient-rich waters that live in Antarctica. So all of the, essentially, plankton and nutrients from the bottom of the ocean around Antarctica comes up and then is pushed around the world that feeds everything. You know, we know whales, for example, migrate up and down the coasts of Africa and South America and Australia because all the nutrients kind of feeds all the animals all throughout the world and, you know, they come down to Antarctica to eat and gorge, and then they go up to Northern Australia, for example, to breed, and then they come back down in the cycle. But if all that nutrients is disrupted, if those temperatures are disrupted, everything to do with like a whale's life, for example, is disrupted. You know, they're going to be breeding at the wrong time. We already see whale numbers or whale pregnancies are dropping because of things like ocean currents changing and access to krill, their main food source, is changing. So I'm worried about a heck of a lot, not just about me, but for all of the amazing wildlife that live on this planet, not just the ones that live in Antarctica too. So there's a lot of threats that are facing Antarctica, and if it's not dealt with, then Antarctica will deal with us, essentially. So there's a big threat, and it's Antarctica itself, I think.
That's a really interesting way of putting it, kind of personifying a continent, which... nothing wrong with that. But yeah, it's sort of, to me, the scary thing is we're running this giant global experiment and we're like, I don't know what's going to happen. We don't even really have a hypothesis. We're just kind of running around being like, we'll see what happens.
Yep.
And that's those cascades.
Yep.
That sort of like, you think it's real nice and slow now, but you won't necessarily get to be a boiling frog.
Yeah.
It might go faster.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing with Antarctica, right? It's like kind of the foundation or the bottom of like the food pyramid, for example. If you take away the legs on a table, then the whole table collapses. And it's the same with so many aspects that Antarctica is involved in. And right now it's shaking, you know, it's not that steady. So yeah, I think people are just kind of disconnected from Antarctica. We're not connected enough to it because it's so far away and inaccessible for the vast majority of people. So we don't see it, then it's not in trouble. You know, it's hard to connect with a place like that, which I think is why, you know, these documentaries like Planet Earth and things like that are so amazing, because they bring you in and they don't just show you the amazing whales and the, you know, the polar bears in the Arctic. They also show you, you know, the polar bears that are now starving because there's not enough ice for them to walk around on. You know, these naturalists are showing you both sides of the argument, which I think is so important too, and it brings us in a lot more.
Yeah, it's very sort of engaged. On a slightly side note, so do you now want to do a winter season down there?
I don't know about winter. winter would be something else. That is, you know, minus, I think the coldest temperature ever recorded on the planet, which is in Antarctica, was minus 88 degrees, I think. Yeah.
It's also dark.
It's also 24 hours of darkness. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you can't see because there's no light and it's minus 88. So there's a lot of just terrible things happening. I would love to go kind of the tail end of Antarctica when it's still a little bit more hospitable for me to go anyway. You know, it's still very cold and it's still very icy. it's a completely different place. You know, I went in summer, which was, yeah, kind of mid to late February when I went. If you go in kind of October or like early November, it's a completely different place. You know, different animals are there. The landscape has changed. So I would love to go and see that side, is because we keep hearing as well, like there's record low ice coverage in Antarctica for 3 years in a row now. We've beaten the record every single year for the past 3 years. It's getting worse and worse and worse. There's less ice every year. And I would love to go and see that side of it as well, because, you know, that's something I wasn't as connected with in the summer, because, you know, the sea wasn't predominantly frozen. But if you go in October, it mostly is. So that's a whole nother side of Antarctica you'd get to see. So maybe not winter, but kind of the shoulder of winter and spring, I think, would be my next idea.
Yeah, that'd be very cool. So it sounds like this was all quite, I mean, not life-changing in that you're already like broadly on this track, but, you know, galvanizing maybe. What's next? Like, what does this make you want to do?
Yeah, and this is, I think, a dilemma that goes through a lot of people's minds when they come back. Well, hopefully a lot of people's minds. And it's such an incredible place. It really does make me, anyway, you know, reevaluate kind of your place, you know, what you do on this earth, whether it is professionally for a job, but even kind of in terms of your carbon footprint, you know, are you living sustainably, or could you live a little bit more sustainably? You know, are you doing the best that you could to try and mitigate your impact on the planet? You know, because like I said, sort of towards the beginning, there's all these regulations around the tour operators, you know, what they can and have to do to meet these sort of regulations. But our own footprint is ours to mitigate. You know, we're responsible for our own lives. We're not responsible for the boat. So, you know, there's lots of little things, you know, that I and everybody can do that we've been talking about for a long time, you know, like switching to eco-friendly soaps and, you know, taking public transport less, things like that. We know about all of that, and it's
taking public transport more.
Oh, sorry, taking public transport more. Yes, please take please take more public transport, definitely. There's lots of little things like that we've been talking about for a long time, and I think a lot of people are kind of on board with, but there's a lot of other things that we kind of, again, feel a little bit more disconnected with. You know, there's like new gas mines and oil rigs going up all around the planet, and they're disrupting things like whale migratory patterns, and they're impacting the local food chains that are there too. There's other things that we hear less about because it's not in the media, of course. But that's why subscribing to, you know, places or organizations like WWF and Greenpeace and marine sanctuaries and all of this, they inform you about what is going on that you aren't aware of and ways that you can help. It could just be, you know, making a donation. It could be, for example, on Saturday, I'm going to Torquay as part of like a swim protest to go and protest the seismic blasting of an area to hunt for gas mines, which is exactly the area where whales breed, for example. You know, I haven't seen this on the news. I haven't seen it any other place other than the charity that I followed on Instagram. So there's lots of different places that you can find more information. It's just unfortunately hidden. I would love to keep doing this sort of work and making my voice a bit louder, you know, talking to you, for example, getting the message out about Antarctica and its threats is one thing that I would love to keep doing. I would also love to go on these if they continue to run. You know, I think I would be great to go and communicate on these boats to people about all of these threats. I think my particular skill set, everybody's got different skills, and I think my skill set lends itself to something like that. I might be able to go on and talk a bit more effectively or reach a bit more people on these boats and get them a bit more connected with Antarctica and things like that. So I think everybody's got a different skill set and a different circumstance. There are things that all of us can do, like taking more public transport, but it's evaluating your own circumstance as well and looking at what you think you can change in addition to things like that. So it's definitely a personal response or responsibility, But we've got to get people connected to, you know, change minds and things like that. So that's probably the hardest thing that I and other people that I know are trying to work on as well.
It's an interesting long-running challenge. And I agree. I think you'd be great on the ships. And I think that'd be a really fun job.
It would be.
And yeah, I mean, there's people who like hear you talk and be like, yeah, he's onto something.
Mm.
I'm going to go home and change my power to green power or whatever.
Yeah.
And that'd be cool. Good luck
with that. Thank one. Thank you, yes.
But yeah, I think, like, I know I'm totally on board with personal responsibility. I also think we need a bit more corporate and governmental responsibility. Like, it's not just on me to use a reusable cup. Like, we need some bigger scale stuff, because I personally can't stop someone, like, individually can't stop them doing the seismic testing. But
no.
There's some people who sit at very comfortable desks who can.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's why, you know, trying to get the message out, you know, even writing to your local MPs and things like that to voice your opinion on X project that you feel negatively about, that all matters as well. We are part of like a greater collective, you know. It's not that, you know, one person's voice doesn't matter, but adding your voice to other people's is what is really gonna sort of make that change.
Yep, definitely. Is there something you would like encourage listeners to do or change that like out of this trip?
I would encourage everybody to sort of think about your impact on the planet and how you can mitigate your impact or lessen your impact. There are some amazing lessons that we can take from like Indigenous people's knowledges as well. You know, they live in harmony with the land. You know, we just take everything from the land in this very capitalist sort of approach, you know. Trying to get or encourage people to become more connected with either the land that they're on or the land like that, in this case, Antarctica, for example, you know, because if we're not connected, then we just don't care about it enough. Because we're not going to hear about it, we're not going to see it enough. So it's kind of on our own dime, on our own energy to feel more connected. So to these places like Antarctica and even the land that you are on, you know, I'm here to sing the song of Antarctica, but, you know, we've also got terrible situation in Australia, you know. We've got the worst extinction rate, mammalian extinction rate on the planet, you know. We could chat for a whole nother hour just about that. So it's about, again, sort of grounding yourself in where you are and what you can do. You know, not everybody has the privilege to go to Antarctica like I did, but also, you know, not everybody has the privilege to go, you know, to a kind of surfing protest like I do on the weekend as well. So again, it's kind of trying to ground yourself in where you are and what you can do to help. And I think there are so many organizations out there that can help you identify that as well. You just got to do a little bit of Googling as well, I think.
I think like adding to that is you don't have to do this sort of stuff by yourself. Like, it's not just you wandering around doing your thing. Like, that's good and it's impactful, like useless glad rep, that's awesome. But like, by joining in organizations like what you've mentioned, there's a lot of power that comes from just like amplifying what's already out there.
Yep.
Rather, you don't need to start the new thing necessarily.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, we don't need to reinvent the wheel on a lot of this. You know, there are a lot of organizations out there all doing very similar things, like, you know, trying to make more marine parks to protect whale breeding sites, for example. We're not saying go out and make your own organization that, you know, that stands for the same things. You know, we're saying go and find the people that think and stand for the same things that you do. You know, and I've mentioned, you know, WWF is like just one sort of blanket organization, because yeah, adding your voice to others amplifies the message, and that is what's going to reach people like the politicians, and they're the ones with all the power in the world. So if we can become part of a greater collective, then they're going to listen and then they're going to act, I think.
Are there any other ways that you'd sort of like to bring in this case Antarctica, I guess, into people's homes in a good way, not in the like scary knock knock way?
Again, I think it's a lot of the organizations that I've already mentioned. If you do sort of join up, whether it's, you know, a newsletter for free, or you donate $5 a month or whatever it is, you know, there are so many resources that they actually offer you to connect you with the cause and with Antarctica in this case. and positive lights as well. You know, like your voice has helped us do this work, which is benefiting penguins in this way. You know, even just hearing from organizations that you're not necessarily donating to or taking a part of directly, I think is going to connect you so much and bring a place like Antarctica more towards the front of your mind. And hey, if you want to buy like a penguin plushie, you know, that the WWF sells from recycled plastics and things like that as well, hey, that's beautiful too, and maybe that'll get your kids involved, things like that. I think there are a few ways, but those organizations that work in these spaces have so many resources that can help connect you a lot more, but you've got to go out and find them and then, you know, sign up to whatever it is. So yeah.
Sounds like a good call to action. It's just like, think about something that you care about a little bit, whether it's rainforests or dry land or Antarctica, and find some orgs that are doing some work and sign up to some newsletters, because it sounds like a really nice soft place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. It all comes down at the end of the day to, you know, empathy and education. You've got to empathize with the planet, the people, the animals, the country, and then educate yourself on what is being done and what you can do as well.
Do you feel like the other people on the cruise would have got, like, come home with a similar energy, at least some of them?
I think definitely some, but also definitely not all. I said at the beginning, you know, some people just go for the bucket list and they're just going there to see the ice and the penguins. And they may have come away with, you know, learning a bit more about Antarctica. The guides, the expedition staff that we go on are fantastically passionate and compassionate and knowledgeable people, and they're great communicators as well. I was really impressed with how they could reach so many people. So I'm hoping that a lot of those messages did rub off. You know, I don't think as many people would be, you know, as passionate as I am, for example, but I went there already passionate and wanting to sort of, you know, increase that fire and see where I could, you know, be more useful. So I think everybody would have come away with a new or more appreciation for it. Whether that led to kind of long-lasting, meaningful change, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that a lot of people were really moved and would have come away with some of these messages of, it's in trouble and it's our fault, how can we help? I think a lot of people would have come away with that for sure.
Kind of not surprising, but it also reminds me of something one of my guests years ago said, is that like we need a lot of people talking in these spaces in conservation, because different people are only going to be able to hear your voice. Like they're not going to hear that same message from someone else. And I have a suspicion it'd be the same with like landscapes. Like for some people, Antarctica is going to be the thing that hits them and that's really going to make that message sink in. But for other people, they might need to see like the middle of a desert or like a beautiful tropical island that has some plastics in the sand or something, and that's the thing that'll sink in. So yeah, it kind of makes sense that Antarctica wouldn't be like the tipping point for everybody.
Yeah, and it's the unfortunate thing that we're very much visual learners, you know, to go and see Antarctica for a lot of people will be that change, but again, not for everybody. But that's why we've got to diversify our communication strategies. You know, we can't just keep putting out documentaries of David Attenborough and thinking that it's going to change the world. We need to think of other ways as well and come up with new ways to reach everybody. You know, everybody needs to be connected in some way, and everybody learns, and we all learn in different ways. So, you know, breaking outside of your circles, I know as well, seems like something that we have the control of, but we really have less control of it than we think, you know, with all the algorithms that give us the targeted ads for all the things that they think we want to hear about. So it comes down again to people making the conscious effort to go and search for something that is either not or that's not right in front of them already.
Yep. And you never know the thing that's going to like make the little light bulb switch on in people's brains. I've seen it happen like randomly sometimes, and you're like, how was that the thing that spoke to
me? Like, yeah, but let's roll with it.
I mean, it's great.
Yeah.
But I'm not vibing with that. But
yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. And, you know, we're only really going to find out unless people keep digging and, you know, what's going to be that light bulb moment. So encourage everybody to go digging.
Yeah. Just like explore the world.
Exactly.
It's awesome. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share?
Yeah, look, I want to kind of echo that. I am very much one of the very privileged few that has gone, and I know that most people on this planet will never go and will be hard to connect with a place that you can't go or haven't seen or haven't put your feet on the ground or you haven't seen a penguin in person, you know, things like that. But I can't understate and undersell how important Antarctica is and how fragile it is. It's just under so many different threats, and the majority are our fault. You know, a lot of the time with all of this kind of sad news and rhetoric, ignorance is bliss. You know, we don't really want to hear about it because our life, kind of being able to drive to work every day, was a lot easier than it is rush hour public transport, for example. But we've got to realize that there's a greater purpose for all of this, and we have a responsibility to protect this planet because we're the ones that are destroying it. So please, you kind of think about your place, think about how you can be more sustainable in small or large ways. Keep digging, you know, look at ways that you can help directly or work with kind of organizations that kind of do it on your behalf. Because if we keep going down this very kind of, not a rabbit hole, but it's kind of a domino effect. If one thing goes, then another thing will go, and then another thing will go. So, you know, if the sea ice goes, the krill goes. If the krill goes, the penguins go. If the penguins go, the killer whales go. If the krill goes, the whales go too. So there's lots of different steps in this potentially very threatening situation for us. It's just about empathizing and understanding what's going on and educating yourself on how you can help.
I am really curious to see what you're going to do next.
Me too.
To wrap up, do you have a shout out, a virtual high five that you would like to share with us?
Oh, absolutely. Virtual high five to all of the expedition staff that were on my trip. I went with, I think there was just under 30 crew on my trip. It was an intrepid travel expedition, and they were all so incredible. They lived such busy, busy, high pace, high stress lives while they're on the trip. You know, they're responsible for all of us, and they're responsible for all of the wildlife and flora and fauna while we're there too. So it's a massive job, and they executed everything just so seamlessly and beautifully, and their passion and everything just exudes and it rubs off on all of us. So a massive, massive shout out to Steffi Walker, who was our expedition leader, and all of the other expedition staff as well. They made the trip because they connected you so much more with everything when you were there. So huge shout out to the Intrepid Travel team.
I love it. I'm just going to add also a shout out to all of the scientists and researchers working down there and the ones who are psyching up for the winter season.
Yep.
Because you guys are intense, but you're awesome and you're doing a really,
yes,
really important job.
So. Unsung heroes for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, Dr. Jared. Really excited to see what you do next, and, you know, just good luck.
Thank you, and thank you for having me again.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, please pass it on to someone else who you think might enjoy it as well. And if you want to support Avid Research this year, that would be amazing. You can buy us a coffee, head to avidresearch.com.au and there'll be a link, buy me a coffee, and you can support us with a one-off little coffee payment. Thanks so much for listening. You're a legend.